Yeah, today's talk is going to be about fluctuation and correlation forces in Coulomb fluids. And this is going to be an overview. We're not going to go into lots of details, but of course we'll be happy to discuss that after the talk or even during the talk. And that's based on collaborations Rudy and I had in the past. And also an overview. I start with a general overview of the classical, you know, results for charge systems, some of the earlier works, and then I briefly review the recent developments that have been achieved based on the field theoretic formalism that David and Ron also discussed in their talks. As a model system, I'll focus on two uniformly charged and identically charged planar surfaces. That's like the standard model. And discuss weak and strong coupling, limits of the Coulomb fluid. And then Rudy is going to continue with the more interesting stuff. He's going to discuss the case of two asymmetrically charged surfaces. And then if there is dielectric discontinuity at the boundaries, we have, of course, image effects and van der Waals forces. And at the end, we are going to discuss what if the charge distribution on the planar surface or other geometries is not uniformly distributed, but it is disordered. And there you have another force coming from the fluctuation type forces coming from the disorder in the charge distribution on the surface of on the boundaries. And that can compete with the van der Waals effect. So this is a short reminder. Charge systems, consist of, mobile particles, which are referred to as cantons and coions. The most interesting biological applications, you have a large separation of length scales. You have big particles that are charged, and they are referred to as macroions, and there are the small ones. If they have the opposite charge, they're cantons, and similar charge coions, you can have spherical, cylindrical or linear geometry for your macroions, and as well as planar geometry, a combination of all these, different geometries. And the real systems are actually very complicated, both in terms of geometry and interaction. The most interesting questions have been concerned with the structural properties and phase behavior of these systems, equation of state, electrokinetics, and all these questions actually go back to the understanding of the effective interaction between charged objects in these fluids. Now here, to be able to understand these interactions, we need to first understand the charge fluctuations in the medium. So this is actually treated like a continuum. We take, of course, care of the discrete nature of the small ions, so you count the correct entropy and everything. But then, since you have this big separation of length scales, you come up with continuum theories. And we have to understand charge fluctuations in the medium, and if the charges are mobile on the surface, if they are disordered, that has to be taken into account as well. Perhaps the earliest motivation, as far as I can tell, for studying Coulomb system has been the question of stability of charge systems. Right? If you have a collection of particles in vacuum or in a solvent, Even if they are neutral, they're going to attract because of the universal van der Waals forces that have been discussed in this workshop a lot. And therefore, they might aggregate and sediment in the presence of gravity, and that's bad for many applications. And the easiest way out is perhaps just adding charges. If you add similar charges, they're going to repel. But as soon as you add charges on the surface of macrons, you're adding also cantons to neutralize the system. And it turns out that this makes things more complicated and the system might collapse again. And this is a very fundamental issue here, that the system has to be electroneutral. And apparently people have been concerned about the stability of charge systems for a long time. As early as 1842, we have Earnshaw's paper on the nature of the molecular forces which regulate the constitution of the luminiferrous ether, where he discusses or proves the theorem that we know as the Earnshaw's theorem, these days, that no stable equilibrium is possible under electrostatic forces for a collection of point charges. Now, perhaps so in the beginning of 20th century, we see that there are a few classical works emerging on the statistical mechanics of charge systems. For example, Goy's work, Chapman's on the statistical mechanics of double layer, which means a charge surface and a, you know, gas of co and cantons next to it. And then Debye-Huckel works on the equation of a state of electrolytes. And perhaps the marvelous era is early 1940s, where we have Dreyagin Landau's work on the calculation of disjoining pressure between two charged plates. And this is a copy from Verwien Orbig's classical, you know, text, that you can calculate this pressure as a sum of two contributions. One is the repulsion provided by electrostatics, and it's not just electrostatics, of course, that includes also entropy, as we can see here, as well as an attraction coming from the van der Waals forces. Now, the electrostatic part is calculated from the Poisson equation, and on the right-hand side, you have the charge distribution weighted by the Boltzmann weight. So there are two exponentials here for co and cantons that lead to the singe, and the entropy is here, of course. And maybe this is the point we deviate from Enshaw's theorem, that we no more have a Laplace equation. We have something different, and the entropy is actually the stabilizing factor in these systems. So because you have this difference in the scales between macroions and coions, the things are different from what Enshaw considered. And that's...
Irving Langer wrote a paper in 1938 where he saw that same thing that Landau and Dreyagin saw, that you look at the osmotic and the electric stress. And he actually was the one, I think, who showed the generality of a repulsion and the conditions for attraction. That was 1938. Mm-hmm. So it may be in the pantheon.
I think they cite his work in their work.
Oh, yeah. Totally. I just say, I mean, I said it on the blackboard.
Yeah. I mean,
that's probably where I learned about it.
Yeah, that's nice. That you have to add that. But this is meant to be very brief. But now let me. This you have seen perhaps a lot, but this is a very intuitive way of seeing that for two planar surfaces, you have repulsion due to electrostatics, which is exponential decaying and attractive, which is minus 1 over d squared due to van der Waals forces. If you put them together, you can get curves like that with two minima. That's the secondary minima at finite separation, where the colloidal system can be stabilized. There is a potential barrier and a primary minimum where the system is collapsed and then is stabilized by short-range forces or steric forces at small distances. So this is called DLV theory, that is perhaps the first, you know, systematic theory to understanding the properties of charge system in the presence of charge boundaries, not bulk properties. And this is a short review of the electrostatic part, which is based on the Poisson-Boltzmann equation as I just showed you. But here I'm just considering cantons, no coions. And actually, it turns out the cantons are the most, you know, important for our purpose, because they are the one that attract toward the charged surfaces and lead to correlation effects. And the coions usually hate these surfaces and go away. But they are important too. They, you know, contribute to the screening of interactions and so on. So you can start with a Landau-Ginzburg type free energy. You add the energy and the ideal gas entropy of cantons. So the idea is, so you construct the trial energy, free energy. So if the if it was up to the energy, the cantons would prefer to sit on the surface, because then they minimize the energy. To maximize the entropy, they would like to disperse uniformly. But when you put them together and minimize this free energy, which consists of the energetic contribution, this is a charge field coupling, the field energy and the entropy of mixing, you end up with a non-trivial profile. The cantons are attracted toward the surface partially, and less populated in the middle, and the profile is not uniform. And that is the typical Poisson-Boltzmann profile that follows from the Poisson-Boltzmann equation for the electric potential field, and if you calculate the pressure acting on each surface from the Maxwell tensor or from this free energy, which is the same, you realize that the pressure actually goes like kT, the density of ions at the midplane here. That's like an ideal gas equation of a state. Therefore, the pressure is repulsive within the Poisson-Boltzmann theory. That is, of course, for symmetrically charged plates. Like the charge distribution is the same, surface charge distribution is the same on the two surfaces, and there is no net electrostatic stress at the midplane. It's only the entropy. So they're going to repel. And this was the main framework for studying properties of charge systems for a long time, until about maybe late 60s and early 70s, where perhaps Ozawa was the first one who started thinking about fluctuations around the mean field solution. So in his book, he has one of his papers, he has a hand waving sort of scaling way of putting fluctuations into the theory. So he starts with the Poisson-Boltzmann distribution. I think he does it for two cylinders, and he come up with an attractive term. And then probably things didn't develop a lot until early 80s, where we have lots of simulations and new simulation methods developed by many people, including Torrey and Valio. And around this time, radical simulations of charged particles in confinement, like inhomogeneous Coulomb fluids with two charged surfaces, and he saw attraction, but he attributed this attraction to an error in his code, so he didn't believe it. So this is the story, this is the saying. And in a few years, Gulbrand and Jonsson, Wenström, and Lindsay come up with a with their fundamental paper, where they simulate the same system and establish the attraction in the presence of divalent cantons, and they actually can they have actually clarified that this attraction is real and is coming from a correlation term in the stress tensor. So they sort of maybe for the first time adopt the correlation forces for these sort of additional attraction. And on the theoretical side, around a few years later, around 88, Rudy came up with a field theoretic representation of the same system, and I will talk about in a few minutes, and showed how actually fluctuations around the mean field theory can lead to these attractive forces. But then things got worse and worse, because after that there appeared many simulations. People saw the same thing. So here's an example. You have two cylinders. This is a work by Gernberg Jensen in 97. As you look at the interaction between two cylinders as a function of separation, and you see that if you increase the cantor valency from 1, 2, and maybe 4 in their units, a strong attraction develops between the rods. And even when you have many cylinders, in this work by Lyubartsev around 95, they could see attraction in the presence of divalent and canton. Now, the valence of canton is important, and most people actually look for attraction by increasing the valence of cantons. And in a minute, we'll see that this could be understood in terms of a general coupling parameter. Now, here are a few more slides. Like Perlinzer has these nice simulations where you have only electrostatics, no specific forces or anything, and you increase the cantor valency, and you see that the system collapses into a big aggregate. So you have a small cluster here and a big cluster, and he can measure in the simulations the forces and actually can establish the attractive forces. And there are also experiments that indicate that there are attractive forces of electrostatic origin. For example, these are experiments on microtubules done by Cyrus Safini at UCSB. So maybe this picture is more clear. So you start with a solution on microtubules and change the cantor valency. So if you have divalent cantons, you have necklace bundles, And as you increase the canton volency, apparently long-range attraction or in, strong attraction develops between microtubules, and you end up with big bundles where the microtubules are ordered in a hexagonal manner. And similar things in laminar system, but I'm not going to discuss this. But there are many many experiments also in DNA system. But of course, in reality, you have lots of other things. Like you have specific forces, short-range forces, structural water at the short distances where the attraction emerges. And this is really tricky. And not everything is electrostatics. This can be a brief overview of the theoretical works in the past 30 years, maybe. This is not complete or not even representative, but the general idea is that there have been two approaches. One can be called high temperature approach, the other one low temperature approach. So in the high temperature approach, you start with the mean fit equation, mean fit solution. You perturb around the mean fit solution. You consider the Gaussian fluctuation, first leading order fluctuations around the mean fit solution, or higher orders that I think David and Ron have considered second loop. So the first work was perhaps C2 Ozawa, and then Nienhahn and Adrian in 75, and Rudy and other people, Meron, and actually many works on the, in this area. And on the other hand, you can start with the another fixed point where the canton valency is really large, or the system is at small in a medium with a small dielectric constant, low temperatures, and correlations are very strong, and you can perturb around that. That was the original work by Rusina and Bloomfield that basically started with two crystals, you know. Surface and cantons are almost crystallized, and they bring them together, and you have an interlocking, you know, pattern when the system tries to minimize its free energy, and that leads to attraction. And then Shklovsky law, other people. And in 2000, we started to understand that these both these limits can actually follow from the same fluid theory, from the same theory by tuning single coupling parameter. So there is a crossover from a weak coupling limit to strong coupling limit just by changing this coupling parameter that I talk about. And after that, people have tried to understand the intermediate regime, how this crossover happens, and there has been lots of extensions around that. Let me talk briefly by just focusing on planar surfaces what these weak and strong coupling limits are. As we start with the Coulomb interaction, it turns out that there are two fundamental length scales in the system. One is the Biram length, that is the length where two elementary charges interact with thermal energy KT, as you know. And there's the Gooey-Chapman length, where if you have a charged surface of surface charge density sigma, the attraction energy of a single canton to the surface becomes the order of KT. Okay, so this is like a thickness of a double layer at the surface. The ratio of LB to lambda is a dimensionless parameter. You can call the coupling parameter. Actually, it turns out to be the relevant parameter in the theory, and it goes like canton valency z to the power 3, the Biram length to the power 2. Now, a Biram length can be considered as a dimensionless inverse temperature, so it's like 1 over temperature to the power 2, and the surface charge. So for some real systems, I have put the numbers here. For example, for DNA, you have sigma about 1 electron per nanometer square. If you have monovalent, divalent, trivalent, tetravalent cantons, you go from 220 to 75 to about 200 in the coupling parameter. And same for charged membranes. For large particles like polystyrene particles, they have large charge, but they have a big radius as well. And the surface charge density is small, and the coupling parameter tends to be rather small for these systems, and we expect the weak coupling results apply for these systems. Now, let me look at the two limits. And maybe the best is looking just at the single charged surface. Now, let's start from here. You have a single charged surface here, and the cantons of valency Q. And let's first look at the situation where the coupling parameter is small. So as I said, it's on the board. The coupling parameter is the ratio of the Biram length, the thermal energy, the scale of interaction between cantons, to Biram length, the scale of interaction with the surface. Now, if that parameter is small, it means that the interaction with surface is weak. the thickness of the layer is large, the system is, so you have a rather diffuse cloud of cantons at the surface, and it turns out that the density profile is algebraically decaying, and it goes like 1 over z plus constant, that's the Biram length to the power 2, in some risked units. And you can see the same thing in these actual simulations at coupling parameter equal to 1. And if you have a large coupling parameter, when psi is large, it means that the Biram length, the Goey-Chapman length, which is the layer thickness, is very small. The particles are highly attracted toward the surface, but at the same time, the Coulomb interaction between particles becomes large. Why? So the Coulomb interaction is LB divided by the typical distance between ions, A perp. What is A perp? A perp is given by the local electron neutrality, so charge of the canton divided by surface charge. And in these units, the units of the Goey-Chapman length, we see that this goes like a square root of the coupling parameter. So the distance between ions becomes large. At the same time, the Coulomb interactions becomes large. That is like a 2D plasma parameter. So the systems become highly correlated 2D layer. So you end up with a quasi-two-dimensional layer where the repulsions are strong. So that looks like a strongly correlated liquid in two dimensions, and actually you can see that in the simulations. You start, this is a view from top. You start with a small coupling parameter, larger, and at about less than 10 to the 5, you have a transition to a Wigner crystal phase, and contours actually form an ordered layer. But the density profile, so we are not actually interested in this limit. So most of the physical coupling parameters in the strongly coupled systems, like microtubules, DNA with tetravalent cantons, trivalent cantons, are in this regime. And this is what we are discussing mostly in this talk. And you realize that the physics is just determined by a single ion, because each ion is surrounded by a big correlation hole of size A perp, which is large at large coupling parameters relative to the Goey-Chapman length. And the interaction, of course, the retro interaction is large, but that's not important. The interaction with the surface is like a single particle interaction, and you end up with this barometric density profile. And things become rather simple, because here you have many particles, and the algebraic density profile follows from these many particle effects. So in average, every particle sees the mean field of other particles. Here, things become single particle and might turn to be much simpler. Now, for two plates, this is the mean field that I showed in a previous slide. In the strong coupling limit, the charge is large or the temperature is small. Every canton is somehow trapped in a large correlation hole. And you have like a mosaic bonding. This canton is attracted to this surface and that one to this, and you bring them together, you have an interlocking pattern. Or you can think like that. You have one canton and two neutralizing patches of the surface because of this. Every canton chooses a section of the surface to confine itself in it that neutralizes its charge. Now, do a simple electrostatics. Z is equal to the charge on these two sections, and sum up the interaction, so the surfaces repel, this surface attracts the canton, this surface attracts the canton, put them together, sum, it is attractive. And of course you have to add the entropy of cantons, that I'm going to talk about that can stabilize the system. But now how this is achieved? This follows from theoretic formalism that was first perhaps put forward by Edwards and Leonard in 62 for a one-dimensional system that David and Ron discussed in their talk in detail. You start with your Coulomb Hamiltonian. This is for a surface, and you can transform using Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation your grand canonical partition function to a full theoretical representation. This is a pass integral over different realization of the potential across the system, and you have an effective Hamiltonian or an action that has electrostatic energy in it, charge on the surface coupled to the field, and this is exponential of phi, forget about h now, h is an axillary field, that is coming from the entropy. When you solve the entropy of ions, that end, that leads to this nonlinear term in the action. That is exact. This is exactly solvable in 1D, and in 3D, so far we have actually only asymptotic results of mean field and a strong coupling. Now let me.
What is
omega? Oh yeah, this is a geometry function. It says that where cations can go and where cannot they cannot. For example, here it is 1 in this solution, 0 elsewhere, because this can be generally applied to any geometry, you know, and not only for planar surfaces, and this will take care of the whole geometry, you know, shape in the theory. Because other integrals are all over all, you know, all the space. Now, you can use the Guichard-Mann lengths to rescale your field theory. And so all lengths, they have a tilde sign, they are rescaled with the Guichard-Mann lengths, and you see that the coupling parameter enters as a single factor in the exponent, and other parameters are independent of the coupling parameter. For example, you can calculate lambda in the strong coupling mean field limit, and it turns out it is independent. So this is well defined. It is independent of the coupling parameter. And so if you have that, at the small coupling parameters, 1 over xi is big, you can use a saddle point approximation or a loop expansion, that is an expansion in powers of xi. And for interaction potential, for example, you can look for this sort of expansion. So you have a first order contribution that is expected to be the mean field theory. A second order contribution has to be proportional to psi, and so on. It turns out that in the opposite limit of large coupling parameters, you can also do a power expansion in terms of 1 over psi. So this might look non-trivial, but once you do that, you realize that you are actually performing a real expansion, which is convergent because you have macroscopic objects. It's not like electrolytes that there we know that the real expansion breaks down. But here it is possible to do a real expansion, and you can see a strong coupling leading order term and then a correction of 1 over xi to the strong coupling result and so on.
Sorry.
Sure.
Just didn't get it. So this capital omega is a characteristic function.
No, it is like a theta function. So, for example, here it is zero outside the, you know, the gap. In the gap, it is 1, and it's zero elsewhere.
It's typically called the characteristic function.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But why is then the field phi of r not also excluded in this non-exclusion?
No, phi is everywhere. Phi, electrostatic field is everywhere.
So you do not, so to say, live just with boundary conditions?
No, no, yeah.
Consider that also inside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Basically, you have an integral over Ri, Rj, right? But mm-hmm. That integral is over configuration of cantons, and there you have to put omega. So you have integral of, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's clear, right? You have integral of dRi for every ion you have omega Ri, which makes sure you're counting only the configuration inside the gap. And when you know, transform it, it just goes to the exponent.
No, I...
Okay.
So the key was that you are not just considering boundary conditions, but you consider the field throughout the consent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the way the coupling parameter enters, actually, in the theory, and everything can be done systematically. Now, for the mean field part, when the coupling parameter is small, the loop expansion just corresponds to a saddle point approximation that was done by Rudy, as I mentioned. And you have your effective action. You look for a solution that minimizes the action. That is the Poisson-Boltzmann equation that you obtain. This is the fixed charge on the surface. This is the entropy of cantons included in this. And then you can look at the second-order corrections, like perturbations around the mean field solution, which could be finite. Look at the fluctuations around the mean field solution, and that would correspond to the second order fluctuational corrections, where you have to calculate the Hessian of this Coulomb action. That actually corresponds to the zero frequency Lipschitz van der Waals term, or the classical Casimir force that we talk about here for this Coulomb system. Now, on the other hand, if the coupling parameter is large, as I said, you can expand in powers of 1 over coupling parameter, and that turns out to be just an expansion in terms of the fugacity or a virial expansion. And in the limit that the coupling parameter is large, you can show that only the first non-trivial terms count, and that would include the zeroth order term, which is like the partition function of the system when no cantorners is present. Okay, no cantorners is present in the system, and that is just the bare interaction energy of the surfaces. And the first order term here would include one canton and its interaction with the charged surfaces. So this is the self-energy. We can discard that. But this is this interaction of the surface charges with one single canton sitting at place at the position r. That is the strong coupling free energy then. And you can calculate, you can go back to the canonical ensemble. You have n particles. You can do all these transformations and get your strong coupling free energy, which has a simple form. This is the bare interaction between the two surfaces, and then the logarithm of the single particle partition function. And again, the idea is that particles, as we know from simulations, are highly isolated in big correlation holes, and the physics of the system in the strong coupling limit reduces to a single particle physics, which is very simple. Well, now let's see what this gives us. Now I'm considering the interaction between two identical planar charged surfaces. In the weak coupling limit, you have, as I said, Poisson-Boltzmann equation plus Gaussian fluctuations. We have this expansion. We want to calculate the leading order term and the corrections. So the leading order term can be calculated analytically. At large separation, it goes like 1 over distance to the power 2. It is repulsive. And the fluctuational term has this form. It has this universal amplitudes. Now, I'm showing that in some rescaled units. That's why you have this Guichapman length here. But the first order term is attractive. It goes like distance to the power 3 at large separations. It has the same expected universal amplitudes. And you have higher corrections, of course. But note that net attraction is not possible here for identical surfaces. Why? Not just because this is going like 1 over distance to the power 3, but because we have assumed that this term is smaller than that, and based on that we have performed the loop expansion. So if this term becomes large, this means that our approximation has broken down. So it's not valid anymore. Of course, this is true for identically charged surfaces. Rudy will talk about asymmetric charge surface and things will be different. So the idea is, again, is that you have to approximate approximately neutral half systems, and they can do nothing but repel each other. Okay. Now, in the strong coupling limit, you have these individual ions in these correlation holes, and you end up with this simple form for the free energy. Minus 1 is just the energetic attraction mediated in this electric neutral system. 1 ion, 2 neutralizing surfaces. 1 over d is just the entropy of ion. This is coming in the pressure from a term like log d or log delta in the free energy. This is stabilizing it at the small separation. So if you minimize that, if you look at the zero pressure point, it is twice the Guichapman length. Now you can see this in the simulations. So here is the Minfield curve, the solid line. The dashed line is the strong coupling theory for infinite coupling parameter. And you begin with the small coupling parameters, go large coupling parameters, and there is a nice crossover from one to the other. And the first order correction already breaks down here, as we know by comparing with simulations. If the coupling parameter is 20, 100, this cannot describe this attraction regime.
Can you say something about the origin of the log? I mean, you said it's, of course, it has a log. I mean,
the origin of log. What's the origin of log? Yeah, it's coming out of the calculations. I don't know if it has any physical meaning. Do you really, Rudy, anything?
The log in the filtration?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I talked about the log here, you know, not there.
I can't... it's subdominant, obviously. But I can't... Offhand, I wouldn't be able to.
You see, there are examples where one asks, this is... Naively speaking, it's a violation of finite size scaling, right? And then one usually has an understanding of that because you have long-range forces.
But this is not the critical system. This is,
yeah.
You are always fluctuating around the superimposed mean field.
Sure, even then. I mean, in the critical case, one also knows the origin of the log is either that you have a competition. You typically have two operators with the same... with the same dimension, though it's a degeneracy of renormalization group eigenvalues. And if you have a log, one has, of course, also to ask the question, I mean, what about corrections? I mean, if you have, let's say, if you get also powers of logs, and things could somehow be something, I don't know.
But why should it be subdominant?
Yeah, this is, yeah.
So it's not
I mean, the whole PB1 is subdominant.
Yeah, in this expression, it is. This is more important than those, yeah.
Yeah, so in this sense, okay, it's subdominant to the square, but there is the logarithmic.
Mm-hmm.
Within this expression, the logarithmic piece is the most relevant.
If you repeat this calculation in general dimension, you will probably find that the log delta over delta some power, just some power law, which which will become probably integer in the dimension you're working in, which might be an indication why you have a log correction.
So for sure, the log correction, because it contains mu, comes from the fact that you're fluctuating around the background.
Yes.
If you do not have a background profile, you only end up with the first term. Say that to you. So if you have just two surfaces, let's say with a uniform counter-line distribution in between, it's the first term. But then because of these tails around the surface, which of course depend on mu, which depends on the surface charge, you get the log delta. I'm not sure how to answer your question, but that's where it's coming from.
But you're sure if you went on to next term that there isn't the log square?
Well, then, you know, the whole weak coupling philosophy would fall apart. You have to go to the strong coupling.
Yeah, this is very weakly convergent. As I said, even at 10, it doesn't describe.
So you're using a continuum model for the surface charge still?
Yeah, the surface charge.
There's no discreteness in the surface.
No.
It's all continuum. Uh-huh. Does anyone do a simulation where they make a discrete
ray
on the surface?
There's lots of
Yeah.
When does it make a difference whether you take a continuum?
Well, you know, with these simulations, you cannot decompose them in this way. Because for discrete charges, boson becomes complicated, fluctuations even more. There's not much you can do, really, on the analytic level. These are the results that are valid for uniform charge distribution.
No, just the point of view of simulations if they show the differences.
Yeah, it's near the surface, yeah, sure. Yeah, they do. At small separations and close to the surface. Yeah, and there are lots of effects. In fact, I'm going to summarize that in a few, maybe a couple of slides I have that I give it to Rudy. So this is a summary of what we know for this standard model. This is like a phase diagram. You plot the... Let me go back one slide. So here is where the pressure crosses the zero axis. So this is the equilibrium separation. And in the mean field limit, it goes to infinity. You can plot this as a function of the coupling parameter. And at large coupling parameter, it tends to twice the Gooch-Chapman length. This is the units of the Gooch-Chapman length. At the small separation, you still have repulsion. The system is stabilized. This is important because when you put disorder in the system, you'll see that the entropy can be renormalized and things will change here. But this is, there's, you know, it's not possible for a system to collapse even at high coupling parameters. The real expansion is valid in this limit. You have Wigner crystallization here. The loop expansion is valid at small couplings. And this is not, you know, reachable by the theory so far. So this is the intermediate regime where you have this, you know, shape. But it's interesting. It's important to know what is the regime of validity of strong coupling and weak coupling theory. Weak coupling, I mean, Poisson boson plus Gaussian fluctuations. You have to make sure that the next leading order is smaller than the leading order, and then it turns out that the distance divided by logarithm of distance has to be larger than the coupling parameters. You always have to look at large separations. At any given coupling parameter, for distances larger than that, the mean field theory work. Now, the strong coupling theory is valid when the separation between the surfaces is smaller than the separation between cantons at the surface. Okay, and turns out that it happens when the distance squared is smaller than the coupling parameter. So at any given coupling parameter, it need not be infinity. We expect that in these regimes, we have strong coupling-like or weak coupling-like behavior, and that can be summarized in this graph. And again, this is a challenging, area. There has been recent works trying to understand this, intermediate regime, but the problem is not completely resolved. Now, this is the part I'm going to give Rudy, and he's going to continue with some more applications.
Which distance is this attractive minimum appears?
Attractive minimum?
Yeah.
So the surface-surface distance, for example, if you have a coupling parameter of 100 for DNA with trivalent cantons, that it would be about few angstroms. But that is referring to the closest distance approach. You have to remove the cantron diameter from that, you know.
But we are talking about
few angles, very small separations.
Short
nanometer. Nanometer, yeah, that's right.
So I will just pick up here from Ali. Yeah.
There's a harm if you plot the heat capacity. Okay, let me make this just interesting. But very briefly, I just say that. So if you plot the heat capacity as a function of per number of cantons, as a function of the coupling parameter, so imagine this is 1, this is 100. And so intentionally I put these numbers. This is the crystallization. So here the heat capacity goes up, and then the correlation holes form. Form on the surface, you enter the strong coupling regime, there's a hump here, and it goes down and diverges at the crystallization point. But it can be shown that this doesn't diverge at the end goes to infinity. So there's a hump, but that is not an indication of the singularity. Because you increase the number of cantons, go to the thermodynamic limit as much as you can go in the simulation, but this is stationary, completely saturated.
Is there some analytical argument for that?
No. Yeah, just for this, for the absence of a space transition here, right?
You said that the specific heat diverges upon approaching crystallization.
Well, in the simulations, they see that it goes like, I'm not sure if it diverges. It goes, becomes very hard, large, but I don't know about the, there are lots of Wigner crystal works. Do you know about them? Do you know if the heat capacity should diverge?
Typically, with the first order phase transition, we would not associate the divergence specific heat.
Is it a first order transition?
That would be interesting. So,
I don't
know. First of all, for crystallization, we expect it, unless you have very special two-dimensional.
Yeah, when you pass 100, you're already almost two-dimensional. So the system is quasi two-dimensional, and this, and
so the character of this freezing transition is not completely.
We haven't looked at that actually. We haven't mostly focused here, then tried to go that far. This is a very large coupling parameter, and there are works actually in electronic systems. There are lots of works on that. If you can crystallize electrons on surfaces and so on.
Not for soft matter systems. You would never go into that regime, of course.
But that's interesting.
Okay, so let me pick up here. What I will use as a framework are the limiting laws that Ali introduced. And limiting laws have always been very important in the study of Coulomb fluids. Just remember the bi-Huckel limiting law. It's very important to know what to expect when you look at the properties of real systems. And what to expect here is that electrostatic interactions are always between two limits. One is the weak coupling limit, and the other one is the strong coupling limit. In between, of course, you can have many things going on which are difficult to capture by any kind of analytic theory. But the two limiting laws always remain valid. And I will try to apply this idea of the two limiting laws to various generalizations. I have a little bit problems with my voice. I'm sorry. Yesterday, after the talk on influenza, I immediately picked up some symptoms. So, I don't know. Yeah, it's on. Yeah. Okay, so I will talk a little bit on the effect of the discontinuous dielectric constant and on the asymmetrically charged surfaces on the disordered charge distribution as they contribute various effects to the interactions between macromolecular surfaces. Images, of course, you all love and adore. They are due to the fact that we have a non-homogeneous distribution of the dielectric properties in the system. If you have two charged surfaces and the dielectric constant in between is different from the dielectric constants in the semi-infinite media, of course, then the interaction potential, which before was just the Coulomb potential, acquires an additional term, which we, after Kelvin, we refer to it as the image potential. And there are various ways to calculate the image potential. Either you sum the infinite array of images, or if you go to the two-dimensional Fourier-Bessel representation, you get a closed-form expression for the image potential that depends, and this is important, not just on the difference of the coordinate, but also on the sum. So it does not; it's not, of course, homogeneous. And if you look at two charged surfaces now that are and the dielectric constant in the region where the counter ions are is different than in the background region in the two surfaces, then you can use in the weak coupling level the same philosophy that Ali explained. So you look at the local local electrostatic potential on the saddle point level that gives you just the Poisson-Boltzmann equation. And of course, on the mean field Poisson-Boltzmann level, there is no effect of the images because it is a mean field. It does not depend on the transverse coordinate, which is what the images are all about. So strictly speaking, on the mean field level, the image effects are non-existent. In the literature, you will find many works where people discuss image effects on the like quasi-mean field level, but there's always something added to the mean field. You cannot get image effects on the mean field level. However, of course, if you go to the fluctuational level, if you look at the Hessian of the Coulomb action, the fluctuations around the mean field can have any Fourier component. So in that case, of course, you're bound to see image effects. So this is the first conclusion, that on the weak coupling limit, the image effects for Poisson-Boltzmann are absent, but they are present in the fluctuational part. And you can see that if I look at the pressure in this system, and I will not go into details, you just saw the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, you look at the fluctuation. In fact, you have to calculate the log debt of the Hessian of the Coulomb action, and that can be done explicitly for the counter ion only system. It's all analytic. And you get with the interaction pressure for the small separation limit and the large separation limit, and you see that both of these terms here and this one here come from the fluctuational part, and of course they do depend on the images. Delta is just the delta that I introduced before, which is epsilon minus over epsilon plus, which is the usual thing that you get in the calculation of the fluctuational part to the interaction energy. Now, on the strong coupling limit, which is again set up in exactly the same way as Ali did it for the case without the images, we have the zero order term is just the bare Coulomb interaction between the surfaces, and at the first order term, which is the proper strong coupling approximation, you will see that what you need to evaluate is Ali had this part before. So this is the interaction energy of one counter ion in the field of external charges. But also, if you have images, the self energy of the counter ion depends on its position. This is the main difference between the strong coupling limit without and with the images. And this turns out to be the most important contribution. This might tell you something more than just about electrostatics. It tells you that a particle that is strongly coupled to electrostatic field, it's the statistics of it in the strong coupling limit is governed by the self-interaction term, not the external interaction with the charges. Now, if you take this properly into account, all these integrals that you need to do are, you can evaluate explicitly and analytically, you see that you get these two pressures for large and small separation. This is OA, and this is OA to the minus third, and you see nicely that the images always enter into the expression for the interactions. Let me tell you that there's a little bit of a, not a problem, but you have to be careful. If you look at the case where the two boundary layers are of finite size, so this is the separation, and this is the finite size, this is epsilon, epsilon prime, and then epsilon again. If you look at this case, and then you go to the case of B goes to infinity, that limit is non-analytic, as you can easily understand, because you always get the polarization charge here as well as here if you have a finite slab. And even if you go to B to infinity, because this is a one-dimensional case, you will still remain with polarization distribution on this side. Whether if you just take B goes to infinity from the start, of course, there's no other end, and the polarization is not going to be there. So you have to be careful to do the limits properly. But apart from that, everything is straightforward. So we looked...
Usually the field gets so big when you get it thick, if you're doing that, you can see that outer charge go to zero smoothly.
Not in 1D. I mean, it's a, as soon as you have a finite, which is always, you know...
It's always a stupid thing.
Yeah. In a real system, of course, this is never going to be a problem. It's a problem because you set up the calculation in an idealized case.
Well, the other question, actually, a long time since I thought about this, the step function interface... Do people examine the sensitivity to the step function?
Not that I'm aware. As you know, we did it for van der Waals interactions, but not for this. Yeah. But not for this particular case.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it doesn't make a difference.
It would be possible, of course. It's not that complicated, I think.
It's easier than what we did. So.
Yeah.
It might be worth it.
So. What we did at the next step is, of course, to compare again the calculations in the two limiting forms with the simulations. And first of all, you have to figure out what is the range of validity of the two limiting laws. And you see that for the strong coupling case, this identity has to be fulfilled, which means that the range of separations, if you have images where the strong coupling is valid, is bigger than without the images. That is the first conclusion, which is very, very important. And you can calculate the interaction free energy as well as the counter ion density profile explicitly and compare it here to simulations performed by Yongsu Zhou from the MRL. A local person here, and let me just pick up to one to compare. So this is the pressure, interaction pressure. Delta is, of course, epsilon minus over epsilon plus at a certain value of the separation between the surfaces. And you see that the comparison of the theory, this is the strong coupling theory, and these are simulation points is excellent. Really, where it works, the strong coupling theory performs extremely well. Also, in this case, this is some other set, I think it's another set of values for the this is a different B, so we go to, you know, we vary this B also and also the A, and again the comparison of the simulation with the underlying theory is very, very good. We also looked at the phase diagram, so the region in the parameter space where you have attraction as opposed to repulsion, and that is also well described by the two limiting laws. The other case I will describe or talk about here is the electrostatic interactions in asymmetric systems. So if you have two charged surfaces, one has a different charge than the other one. This problem has a venerable history, starting from Adrian's work in 72, and then Pinkinson and Lau, 99, and the group of David Endelman, 2007. So what we are discussing here is now the images are gone. It's just that you have two charged surfaces, but the charges on the two surfaces are not the same. So it's an asymmetric system that has two well-defined limits. One is the symmetric limit, where the charge densities are the same, and the other one is the condenser limit, where the other charge density is exactly opposite to the first one. And you can solve the corresponding Poisson-Boltzmann equation analytically in this case. It's not difficult to do. People have done that before. And you can see that there, look at this red line here, the phase diagram separates an attractive region from a repulsive region, and zeta is the quotient of the two surface charges. You can take zeta between 1 and minus 1 because all the other cases map onto this finite strip of zeta between 1 and minus 1. Excuse me?
Can you remind us what D tilde the star is?
D.
D tilde the star.
The vertical axis.
Oh, this is the equilibrium separation divided by mu, which is the Guy-Chapman length. And Guy-Chapman length, of course, depends on the charge linearly. So it's all in dimensional rescaled units. And you see that for zeta, bigger than 1, of course, on the red line. On the Poisson-Boltzmann weak coupling limit, it's always repulsion, and the attraction starts a little bit below zeta equals 0. So even if you have two unequally charged surfaces, it's still... you know, you can still see attraction as well as repulsion. Usually people say that if you have oppositely charged surfaces, of course that should just collapse together. But you have to be careful. There's an energy, there's an entropy contribution of the counter ions that you also have to take into account here. And that, of course, complicates matter. Entropy on the Poisson-Boltzmann or mean field level is, of course, very important. There's a famous dispute between, I think, Sam Levine and Adrian mentioned Langmuir on the sign of the electrostatic interaction. In fact, if you don't take the entropy of the counterions properly into account, you get the wrong sign. You get attraction, which is, of course, ridiculous. So... as for the fluctuations around the mean field, you have to calculate the log debt of the Hessian of the Coulomb operator that contains, so this is the inverse Coulomb potential, but you also have the underlying background mean field density of the counter ions, which is given here for various cases. So this is for repulsive pressure. Pressure equals zero. There is a case like that. And attractive pressure. Now, pressure equals zero is, of course, an anomalous point in the phase diagram, because for pressure, mean field pressure equals zero, the fluctuational part becomes the dominant. Yeah? If the mean field part is zero, then the fluctuational part does all the work. And in all three cases, you can in fact calculate this explicitly by the, you know, this is a general result that you use, that 1/2 trace log of the Hessian is equal to this integral of the so-called secular determinant. That's been proven by Barash and Ginsburg to be an exact reformulation of the trace log. I mean, you can do it in many different ways. This is just one way, where D is the secular determinant. So it's determinant of the coefficient of the resolvent of this operator, which is right here. And you can solve it for the three cases, attractive, repulsive, and zero pressure, explicitly and analytically. And what you get are different results in different limits. So, mind you, this is always the fluctuational part, so I would have to add the mean field part to that. And you see that for if d is large enough, you get log d over d to the third. For intermediate d, it's log d over d to the third. And for large d, it's exponentially decaying. This is for negative zeta, so zeta here is negative. There's a minus here, so it decays exponentially. These are the fluctuational contributions to the interaction pressure, and that's the range of validity that you get from comparing the mean field versus the fluctuational part. And we compare that extensively with simulations performed by Martin Troelsen. And the interesting thing is that on the weak coupling limit, you can see, so look at the simulation points. This is for zeta 0.5. This is weak coupling, very small coupling parameter. If you just take the mean field contribution, it's always above the simulation points. But if you add the second order fluctuational correction, it goes directly through the simulation points. So fluctuation correction actually is important if you want to compare quantitatively simulations with limiting loss. And you see again, just as in Ali's case, that if you increase the coupling parameter, you go from a mean field limiting law to a strong coupling limiting law in the interaction pressure. You are always in between the two. Whatever you do, whichever psi or coupling parameter you take, you are always between the two limits. Also, it turns out, as you go towards negative zeta, so one plate is one surface is positively charged, the other one is negatively charged, you see that that the difference between the strong and the weak coupling limit becomes smaller and smaller. Why is this the case? Because if you have a positively charged surface and a negatively charged surface, the counterions in between feel the field that is superimposed by the two, by the external geometry. And that field actually governs their statistics and shows up in the universal form of the pressure. So if you have a strongly asymmetric system, the two limiting laws, strong and weak coupling, actually start coinciding more and more. Also, if you look at the phase diagram, you will see that this is the Poisson-Boltzmann result, which is corrected a little bit by the fluctuational term. So here's attraction, here's repulsion. But on the strong coupling level, you see that it's a more complicated phase diagram. You have two regimes of attraction, and in between, you have repulsion. D star, again, is the equilibrium pressure rescaled by the Guy-Chapman length, and zeta is the asymmetry parameter of the system. So you can see that you can have a transition from the attractive part through the repulsive part if you vary the asymmetry of the system.
Excuse me, I mean, yes. These points fall always between the two limiting curves.
Yeah.
That's just what you get from comparison. Is this simulation, or can one show this rigorously?
This is rigorous, absolutely. These are the two extreme limits. Yeah, the weak coupling and the strong coupling.
That the limits are okay, but I mean that they are bounded, that the curves, I mean that in between.
Oh, that they're bounded.
In between, the points have to fall.
Yeah, yeah. Can one that show explicitly?
This is a correction to your results. So probably
right.
Size has to be such as they will fall in between.
Yes. I'm not aware whether that's been actually proved rigorously and generally, but certainly for all the cases that I've seen, when you compare with simulations, they are right in between. So I guess there's good grounds to believe that somehow this can be proven in general. So theory versus simulations, and then the strong coupling. This was all weak coupling, and now the strong coupling. Again, you can obtain the exact form of the interaction pressure, the exact form of the counter-ion density. In the two limits of small and large separations, it has these two limiting forms. And as I said, it's valid in this regime of separations. And you can see that the phase diagram just looks more complicated. So red is the weak coupling phase diagram. In blue is the strong coupling phase diagram. You see that you get additional parts in the phase diagram with attraction that you didn't have with the mean field. So it is important. These are qualitatively different limits. And now, if we compare the analytical results with simulations, what I'm showing you now is the counter ion density profile. Again, you see the same trend. As you increase the asymmetry parameter, the two limiting laws, so the weak and the strong coupling, just start coinciding more and more because the counter ions feel mostly the large external electric field imposed by the two surface charges, so there's a very little difference between them. And again, you see that quantitatively, the weak coupling limit and the strong coupling limit perform quite well when you compare them to the simulations. What I'm showing you here is the dependence on the equilibrium spacing on the coupling parameter, and you see how you slowly start approaching the strong coupling limit. For zeta is 0.5, and for zeta is minus 0.5, you are almost there all the time. Only for very small values of zeta, you actually hit asymptotically the weak coupling limit. So again, the two limiting laws are working very well. The last thing that I want to discuss here in the next 10, maybe 10, 15 minutes, is the disorder effects. This was actually, we were prompted to study these effects by the lecture of Andy Kim, who described the high-precision experiments on the interaction between two dielectric bodies. And if you remember, he was discussing also the disorder effects, the fact that you might have patchiness in the surfaces, and so on. So the idea here would be, what would happen to electrostatic interactions if the charge on the surfaces shows a disordered distribution? So you have a little bit of plus here, minus here, zero there, and that's all very disordered and patchy on the surface. So I'm showing you this picture. I'm not sure which experiment is that. I guess it's Perkin from 2005. They look at the patchy surfaces interacting in aqueous solutions. And what you see when the two surfaces are far apart, of course you cannot monitor what's happening to the surfaces as you push them together, but when they're far apart, you can study the distribution of the charges, and here you see the patchiness. So this is positively charged, this is negatively charged, and you see how patchy the surface is. It's really the approximation of a smeared charge on the surface is very poor for this particular case.
And for these micromeasurements, is Jacob Klein.
Jacob Klein, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There are other experiments with copolymers on the surfaces and so on, but basically they all give you this very disordered charge distribution. And let me just stress this again, as you start pushing the surfaces together, unfortunately, you cannot monitor what's happening to them as you push them together. So there are two possibilities here. The charge disorder is just baked into the surface. You prepare it and it stays there as it is. This would be the case of the quench disorder, and as you push the surfaces together, they would interact with one another because of this baked-in disorder. The other possibility is, of course, as you push them together, the charge distribution starts rearranging and responds to the local electrostatic field, and that would be the anneal disorder. It's at the present moment, it's not possible to do, you know, to verify this experimentally, to concurrently, as you press the surfaces together, monitor also the distribution of the charge on the surfaces. So it turns out, I will just go through the broad outline of this analysis. You start with the Coulomb potential, and we already discussed the mean, what we call now the mean coupling parameter. So this is the coupling parameter that tells you whether you are in the strong or weak electrostatic limit. It's proportional to the net charge on the surfaces. And then, apart from that, you also have a disorder coupling parameter that couples the amount of variance in the charge distribution at the surface with the other parameters of the system. And this one goes as z squared, whereas that one goes as z to the third. So the mean coupling parameter would have more a more pronounced dependence on the valency of the counter ion as opposed to the disorder coupling parameter. So what one asks now is what happens in the weak and strong coupling limit if you have also surface disorder in the charge distribution. So these are the question marks. This is what we set out to analyze. So this is just to tell you again the difference between the quenched and annealed disorder. We analyzed actually both. The annealed case is a little bit murkier to interpret, but the quenched disorder is relatively straightforward, and this is what I will talk about. So the model system is two surfaces with disordered charge distribution and counterions in between. Or no counterions. We also looked at that case because remember in Andy Kim's lecture, he is looking at vacuum, interactions in vacuum. So there are obviously no counterions there. And you assume that the charge distribution, the charge disorder can be described via a Gaussian distribution function. And then you look at the, you just use standard devices to treat the effect of the disorder in the quenched limit, which is the one I will talk about. And even before we started that, I remember a conversation with Henri Orlon. It was at a workshop in Korea, and I told him about the disorder that I'm thinking about, and he said, well, probably on the mean field level you will not see any effects. And I was very surprised by that, because I thought for sure, even on Poisson-Boltzmann, you should have effects of the disorder. So he started writing on the blackboard, and he said, no, I'm quite positive that in the weak coupling limit, the disorder will not really matter. You will just, everything that will be, the interaction will depend only on the mean surface charge on the surfaces. And in fact...
Is there something like a Harris criterion for this case?
A what?
A Harris criterion. I mean, this Harris criterion just asks whether the pure system is stable with respect to disorder fluctuations and so on.
No, certainly we didn't prove it that way. I mean, we did the full calculation, and then as you go through the motion and calculate everything, you realize that the term which has a disorder in it is missing.
But can you make up Imre-Ma type argument for the situation?
I don't know. Didn't do it. So what we did is first we proved that for the mean field level there's nothing, so in that case the effects of the disorder are non-existent, so we were very helpful to go to the strong coupling limit, and indeed for that case the effects of the disorder are strong. What I'm showing you here is the interaction free energy. This is the standard term, this one, and minus log d is the separation between the surfaces. This is standard coming from the mean from the strong coupling calculation, and the effect of the disorder is embedded in this kappa term, and kappa is just the disorder coupling parameter that I invoked before. And you see that if you look at the properties, it's quite interesting because the calculation itself is horrible. But then when you go through it to the very end, you end up with this very simple expression for the interaction energy. And so this curve is the strong coupling free interaction free energy. You see that it has a minimum right here. That's the D star that I always invoked in my graphs. And then as you crank up the effect of the disorder, you see that this minimum gradually disappears. First you have a minimum at zero, and then you just turn into a log function that doesn't have, except at very small separations of course, but the secondary minimum disappears. So the effect of disorder in this case is qualitative.
In the case of the decoupling, does the independence of the disorder be independent of the correlations of the disorder for any distribution of disorder? Or do you have certain constraints you need to show that it's
independent? I mean, you mean at the independence of the interaction energy?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, no constraints. I mean, the only thing, actually, the disorder, the way we treat disorder is through its variance. There is no surface correlations. I mean, you can put that in easily, but right now we only have the variance of the surface charge. So if I understand you correctly, you are asking me about the correlation length is, let's say, of the surface disorder becomes large, whether the same result would be valid.
Yeah. Yeah? For Quench disorder, if you put as long as the disorder has Gaussian distribution, if the correlation is long range,
but if you put all the charge in one point here and one point there, it's very, very strongly coupled. And clearly,
no, in the means of limit, when you take the quenched limit,
quenching it, yeah. But you know, just if the correlation is such that all the charge is concentrated, say on the left hand side here and the right hand side there.
Basically, there are two kinds of one is the one you're talking about, when there is some average and there are fluctuations.
Yes, exactly.
And there is a second limit about what Professor Imre is talking about, where there is a dilute system of strong centers, and those should give you different behavior.
Okay. The symmetric charge case that we really talked about is one limit. So you have a plus surface and a minus surface. Like you have big patches, like infinite size. And now they are looking at each other. So the mean term is different, of course, but the fluctuational term goes away in the Quench limit.
Okay. What I said before about the mean field limit and the non-existence of the disorder effect, I have to quantify this a little bit. It turns out, in fact, okay, this is just to tell you if what I said before was valid for a system with counter ions in between, and also if you have a system with salt in between. So this is a univalent electrolyte, which you treat on the weak coupling or the bifocal approximation. The free energy decomposes into a standard mean field term. This is the classical Casimir term, of course. This is the trace log of the Coulomb operator. And the third term, which comes from the disorder, G is connected, G is the Coulomb, G is right here. And the small g is the variance of the disorder in the surface. Now, the... okay, this is not... So, if instead of having the field confined in the slab between the two surfaces, I allow for the spillover in the sense that I have a dielectric discontinuity here. So I should take into account the boundary conditions and the image effects and so on, as I explained to you before. It turns out that even on the mean field level, the disorder will make a contribution to the free energy. And this is our latest result. So let's see how we fare with this one. What I have here is the free energy in the weak coupling approximation for small separation. And you see that the sigma squared, that's of course the bifocal for small separations. Sigma squared over A. But then there's another term that depends on the variance of the disorder. Sigma squared cancels. And it depends also inversely proportional to A. And that's exactly, or the type of, this type of dependence was discussed by Andy Kim. Maybe there's a connection. And even if the net surface charge is zero, the surfaces would still interact because of the variance in the disorder. That's probably the most important result. So you can have a case where the net charge on the surface is zero. It has a disordered distribution, a variance, and it will still interact electrostatically. And the same is true not only if you have the disorder in the surface charge distribution, but also if you have a disordered distribution of surface potentials, whatever they might correspond to. But that's also a case that Andy Kim was referring to. Now, for large separations, on the other hand, you see that the disorder term couples with the bare interact with the bifocal term for small separations. For large separations, it couples with the van der Waals or a classical Casimir term. You see they have both the same dependence on A to the minus 4 kappa A over A. This is the disorder term, that's the van der Waals term, and the bifocal term, of course, has a different dependence. So the disorder term now is not coupled to this one, but it's coupled to the van der Waals term. We have to explore what this means. So I will end up with this slide on the fascinations of the world of Coulomb interactions. This is the Coulomb interaction potential, and you know that it says that opposites attract and equals repel. That's the common wisdom that we all teach in schools, but it's not always true, especially if you have mobile charges in between the fixed charges whose interactions you are studying. Now, in the weak coupling electrostatics, we know that opposites attract and equals repel, just as the Coulomb says, but not quite so much, because the fluctuational contribution always diminishes the interaction free energy. So they still, the equals still repel, the non-equals still attract, but a little bit less than based on the bare interaction. Now, in the strong coupling approximation, it's exactly the opposite. So opposites repel, I would have to qualify this nevertheless. And equals attract, but only if everybody is very charged. So if you have two charged bodies, equally charged, and floating countercharge in between, if that floating countercharge is strongly coupled to the external charges, then the two will attract. And this is a short-range attraction that I described for various cases, and also Ali did before. Now, it appears that if you have disordered charge distribution, not only is the sign of the interaction reversed, but neutrals, neutral body, net neutral, of course, you have a disordered charge distribution, but net neutral body still interact via Coulomb interaction. But only, again, if everybody in between is very charged, so if we are in the strong coupling limit. So with this, I would like to stop. Thank you.
So really, in that last result, if you had charges that did have a very weak net charge, I mean, can this still overcome a weak net charge? I guess it can.
I guess, yeah, sure, yeah. Definitely. The two terms appear to be additive, at least on both, in the both limiting cases. Yes.
If we go to the kind of surfaces that we heard about yesterday, which are patterned, so if you have striped surfaces, presumably there will be lateral forces between them. Would you expect the sign of that to change as you go from one limit to the other? Because everything.
Absolutely, yeah. Offhand, I would say yes. Now, in this framework, of course, we refer to mean field interactions and the fluctuational or Casimir interactions. So mean field would be when you solve the mean field equations for that particular case. Of course, you can do that, if not otherwise numerically. And for sure, you will see, you know, if you have plus minus opposing each other, that would be an attraction, and plus plus would be repulsion. But then if you add more and more polyvalent counter ions, that might change. How much, it depends on the details. But for sure, there will be a lateral interaction in that case. I'm not aware if anybody actually calculated that. Lateral interactions with charged surfaces.
Well, you mean just in some baby limit, like the Bayh-Hugel thing?
Well, yeah, mean field.
Necessarily do it as a learning thing. But really, I'm just trying to get this mean field thing sorted out. So likes and unlikes. If you go just beyond exponential, it's a hyperbolic function, since you're a crash. And it's that next term, I guess, you're relying on to give a difference between like and unlike interactions.
It's unfortunately more complicated. So in the strong coupling limit, there's no mean field. On the weak coupling limit. On the weak coupling limit, of course, if you have plus plus, it's going to be a symmetric distribution of the countercharge, and you cannot. There's a general theorem that's valid for the mean field equations that says in the symmetric case, the interaction can be only repulsive. I just brought up because there was a little bit of a mix-up regarding the interactions. You remember the paper in Nature where people claim that for symmetric boundary conditions you can get attractive interactions, but that is definitely not the case. I mean, there's a general theorem valid for the mean field theory that tells you with symmetric boundary conditions, interaction is always repulsive. You can make very complicated geometry, but still it's going to be repulsive.
I'm asking an easier question.
Yeah.
If I have patches, and sometimes they're unlike facing each other, the next term beyond exponential is dying at a different rate. Is correct?
I guess.
So is that a kind of intellectually shortcut way to see why you would get random surface?
Maybe you could say, you know, you have a...
That they should come out of track.
Maybe you can formulate it in the following way. I'm just improvising, but yeah. In the Boltzmann distribution, of course, the attraction and repulsion are not weighted in the same, to the same extent, because it's a nonlinear function.
Well, I think that's another way to say it, because it's the nonlinearity that gives you these mixed terms.
Maybe that's...
I remember talking with Jacob Klein, why it's coming attracted, and I decided, well, it's just inevitable if you have random patches, because the attractive ones reach just a bit more of the next term.
Well, maybe. The problem with experiments is, of course, that you do not see, you cannot measure the whole force. You just see the collapse. And, of course, that's not enough to compare with any theory. And, obviously, they have some very strong attractive interaction in their case, whatever it's due to. But we would need more. I mean, to compare with this type of theories, you would need the whole separation dependence to be sure what kind of effects you have. Because each of these interaction-free energies with different models has a different separation dependence. So you definitely need that. But the experiment is just very, very complicated,
well,
as you know.
You have these modeled surfaces, and you have to put in a characteristic lateral correlation length, and that, of course, couples to the separation.
Yes.
And I guess you're not doing that here. You're looking locally all the time.
We're looking locally, but it's easily generalized to that case. That's not...
Is it? Because basically that was the kind of question.
Yes, yes.
You know, it gets interesting on the surface, right?
Yes, we will do that also. Yeah.
What did you assume for the correlation of the disorder? You had the variance there. Is it...
Well, we just assume that it's concentrated on the surface and it's fixed.
But the variance is short range?
The very short range, yeah.
So, I mean, then presumably if you take it long range, then you would see that different effects.
Absolutely. Here, I mean, we are prepared to do that, we just didn't have...
My question, I mean, it looked as if it's the analog of the Harris criterion, but since you get a log, it seems to be just marginally... relevant. And if you have long range correlated, it would be worse. But still, one has to ask the question whether your perturbation theory, because you're expanding, whether this is reliable.
A very good question. Unfortunately, in between, if you're not in any of these limiting cases, it's very difficult to do anything.
No, I'm just referring to the treatment of disorder. That's a different story.
Okay.
Disorder is assumed to be small because you are basically looking just at the variance expanding in the disorder.
That's true. You
pointed out that in order to be able to make quantitative contact with actual experiments, one has to consider the appearance of disorder charge distributions. I just wonder whether also another effect might be important. Say if you take glass wall and you put it in water, then you release ions, and this way you charge the surface.
Yes.
Could it be that this release of ions is changed by having a second plate approaching it, so that
This is the case that we usually refer to as charge regulation. So you have some dissociable groups at the surface, and the degree of dissociation depends on the local electrostatic potential at the surface. And that's, of course, strongly coupled between the two surfaces. It turns out, however, that no matter how complicated a model you take for this dissociation equilibrium, the result for the interaction is always between the sigma is constant and phi constant limit at the surface. So you can have, of course, a various complicated way to go in between the two, but it's always bracketed by the two expressions. It's a general result.
But, see, that means, on the other side, if one has now an action experiment situation, you can sit somewhere in the middle, and it's then very hard to tell.
You would, of course, have to assume a model for the surface charging equilibrium and work with that. There's been lots of work on this particular problem. It of course depends what you put in there. You have to have some
quantitative tests between theory and experiment.
You would need an extensive force curve, of course, to see the details of what's going on. It's not enough just to probe a little bit, because you need to have the whole D dependence that will tell you how you go from one, so sigma constant to phi constant limit, as you change the separation. Yeah. Also, you can have, of course, phase separation of the charge on the surface. This is, in particular, if you have lipids. In lipid bilayers, the charge component, of course, is completely mobile. And as you push the two surfaces together, you know, because of the electrostatic coupling between the two, it can go through a transition and make ordered domains. And that, of course, affects the interaction severely. Also, people are interested in that and studying it.
So, I guess we all like image charges because it's kind of neat when we're kids and we read about it. But you're never going to find such a sharp interface in any experiment. And you're usually going to find that the charges that are sitting on the surfaces are out from the low dielectric material by a little bit. So you're getting a very different imaging system than putting them right on the interface.
Which we, you know, we did all three cases, or all two, both cases.
All
yeah.
Two cases.
Both cases. So the charge is a little bit on the inside, or a little bit on the outside. It turns out you are completely correct. Yeah. There's
it's
a difference.
It's madness. I mean, they did this in the 50s with trying to titrate groups on proteins, and they fitted by putting the charge 0.5 angstroms inside the ideal dielectric, the titrator protein.
So let me just add to this that it's very important what you're saying, because if you have a surface that's epsilon 2, let's say, and then aqueous solution is epsilon 80, if you put it inside or outside, makes an 80 over 2 difference.
Absolutely.
In your final result.
Right, which is to say that there's an ambiguity in your infinite separation energy that's huge compared to anything you're calculating.
Well, you have to, you know, you have to have a model. What do we have here? Where is the charge?
No, but I would say you do have the model, but seeing how sensitive it is to the details before, we're going to have to measure these things sometime, and we've seen very little evidence of it in any of our measures.
Well, the best evidence is, of course, the, you know, what we heard about the other day, the Onsager-Samaras result. That's where the images become very important.
Right. And that has a lot of headaches.
Yeah, that's why I asked actually whether anybody measured that for polyvalent counter ions, because you could start thinking about the strong and weak coupling effects in that case. But I guess the experiments are just very difficult to do. Yes?
That's the one. So, concerning this attractive minimum, so you told that this is typically at very short distances.
Mm-hmm.
At these short distances, how much does then the molecular structure of the water starts to play a role, packing effects and homogeneous distributions of that?
Very much, of course. The experiment always gives you a lump sum. Everything's there. From image to water structure to dielectric profile, everything's there. That's why it's very complicated to interpret it. In order to see this experimentally, I think you would need a very clean and very, you know, a system where all the other effects would be relatively small. Otherwise, they will always be hidden in
But now, say, from the theoretical point of view, if you now try to upgrade your theoretical approach by a theory which takes into account the molecular structure.
Okay. Yes. Well,
effect is.
Solvent is very complicated. You can take into account the molecular structure of the counterion. That's easier. So counterions, as you know, come in different varieties, and not all of them are spherical. Especially with DNA, you have counterions which have a very complicated structure. They look a little bit like polyelectrolytes, are extended, and so on. So the first question would be, how much would that affect the, let's say, strong coupling limit? And the answer is, it does not. Only the monopolar term is the one that is making a significant contribution to the strong coupling limit. All the other ones are just gone.
But it might help that they are in a somewhat dilute case. But now I'm mostly worried about the water.
Well, there is a problem. There's As you know, we don't have any theory of...
When we measure forces between neutral membranes, we run into these exponentially varying hydration forces that come out three or four water layers. And you go to a charge limit, you see the electrostatics beyond that. But when you try to come in closer, you're overwhelmed by all the salvation effects. So you're really looking at three or four or five layers of water dominating the interaction. And
yeah, water structure is just very difficult to put into this picture. Of course, one approach would be to do extensive simulations, but then, as you know, you have other problems, unfortunately, like the water-water potential and so on.
You always pointed out how well your theory performs against simulations. You could, why are the simulations so good?
You know, there's a long history of simulating Coulomb fluids, and people have figured out how to do it properly. So you have a double check here. You do the simulations, you compare with the theory, but you also, you know, use the theory to gauge the simulation.
It's a happiness thing. You're happy because the simulation works.
Yeah, we're both happy.
The simulating guy should be happy.
We are both happy. So, of course, for this kind of very simple systems, you can do the comparison. For the experiment, it's more complicated, especially because you're always dealing with water, unfortunately. Water is the thing that's really difficult to figure out.
In vacuum, we don't have water.
In vacuum, yeah, maybe, you know, the experiments of Andy Kim, I think there's meat there. I think that they should be analyzed better.
They care about having really vacuum instead of air?
That was your question. Yes. 10 to the 7th power, minus 7th power.
Because you see, water films are, let's say, 100% hard to fight.
Mm-hmm.
They are omnipresent.
Well, and they were working with gold surfaces, and you know that just from the air, hydrocarbons come down on the gold. And where they were finding gold not being wet, it turned out that it was because there was quite a weight of hydrocarbon on the surface. Virtually none of the measurements, none of the measurements are done under conditions where you are sure there's nothing else on the gold. Because you have to go to 10 to minus 11 or something like that.
This is ridiculous.
Neurotic limits.
Yeah.
So none of the experiments, so very likely they have hydrocarbon at the very least on the surface. That's a good point. Great.
I have a silly question, just to end it. Is it common in this area to use the SI system of units?
Unfortunately, many people do, yes.
First time I saw the SI system being used in a theory talk.
It's the postmodern approach.
You should hear the arguments in our lab.
What? MKA versus CGS system of units. No, we use MKA. Yeah. But that, I guess European system would be more MKS, right? At least in schools, we always teach.
So maybe the government made an age to use it.
They don't care.
The administration were intelligent enough even to know there's such a question.
Don't dare to tell them.
It may
get on you.
Just worry about money. Yes, that's right. Thank you, Rudy.
Okay.